Hello and welcome to The Medley. I'm your host, Blake Crash Priddle. This week we're going to be speaking with a man of many talents, the co-creator of The Red Green Show, Rick Green. He has an extensive resume in the entertainment industry and beyond, and he's going to tell us the story of how it all came to be. Rick, it's good to have you on The Medley. Thank you very much for being with us this week.
You're welcome. It's great to be here.
Was working in the television and comedy industry always your ambition, or did you have other ambitions growing up?
I don't think I had the ambition to do comedy. I enjoyed doing it at school, and then we were making silly 8mm movies, which eventually gave birth to Adventures with Bill, which is kind of interesting. But no, I never thought you could make a living, because when I started out, or when I was that age, coming through university and out the other end of it, really, the comedy in Canada consisted of two things, Wayne and Schuster, and that was kind of it. There was Air Farce on the radio, but I wasn't a regular CBC listener. And then Second City came along, and I'd seen them live, which was a thrill. And it was before, you know, their fame took off. So it was kind of cool now to look back and recall seeing Dave Thomas and Catherine O'Hara and John Candy, of course, and Andrea Martin and so on. It was wonderful. But yeah, no, I don't think I had the ambition. I did comedy in school. I did, a friend and I did a radio show at the University of Waterloo on the campus radio station, and it was music and then horsing around and comedy there. But, you know, my degree is in physics, so it wasn't like I was aiming for a television degree or something like that, or even a degree in writing.
Well, speaking of science, I understand that one of your first jobs was working at the Ontario Science Centre as a demonstrator, you know, a job that also involves performance. Do you feel that that helped you to prepare for performing on TV or on stage?
Yeah, for sure. You learned timing. But even when I was doing that, I'd started doing comedy with my friend Paul Chatto, and then we were doing stuff on the local community access channel, the cable channel. So we had a show that we would, you know, I did a lot of the writing, maybe all of it, I don't recall. And then friends built props and stuff, and the shows were awful. But there were moments of genius. But at the Science Center, I think the ability I honed, and I think it was always an ability that I had, but didn't necessarily appreciate, was to be able to explain something, or read about, or have someone explain something to me, learn about something scientific. And, you know, I had this degree, so I understood it. But when other people tried to explain it to the general public, like anyone who didn't have a degree in science, people got confused and just thought, I'll never understand science and so on. What I learned to do there was to how to explain or develop the ability to explain things in a way that everybody could understand it. And so when I was doing a demonstration, I was in charge actually of the laser area, and we had this huge 40-foot long laser, one of the very first, I think it was at Expo 67 in Montreal. It was in the French Pavilion, and it ended up at the Science Center. And this thing put out 1,000 watts of power, which is, at the time, was the most powerful, when it was built, the first, the most powerful laser. And by the time we got it, and by the time I got there around 75, 76, it was no longer the world's most powerful, but it was still impressive. Of course, I'd say this is 1,000 watts, and we would burn through a piece of fireproof brick. So I put down like these gray sort of light bricks that you would line a kiln with for firing pottery. I'd set that in front of the beam where it was focused, and put a piece of wood, hold a stick behind it on the other side. And after about 4 seconds, the light had burned right through the fireproof brick and set fire to the board that I was holding in my hand, which just astounded people. And then what I said is, this is 1,000 watts. That is as much power as your hairdryer. I said, now that seems silly. I said, but it's basically the power of 10 100 watt lights. And if you've ever tried to unscrew a 100 watt light bulb when it's on, you know how hot the outside gets. Try and imagine how hot it is at the filament in the center. Now take 10 of those and squeeze them down into a pinhole size, and now you know why this burns through the brick. And of course, at that point, people were kind of stunned and, wow. And Star Wars had come out and, you know, and James Bond and stuff, so everybody thought they knew about lasers. And I said, the only thing preventing this from becoming a weapon is finding a holster big enough, because it was 40 feet long, right? And then I said, and what you don't want is to have an enemy who has the ultimate counterweapon, a mirror, which got another laugh. And then I continued, you know, we'll probably continue to kill each other with bullets for the foreseeable future. They're cheap. And that ability to explain things in familiar terms for people. And so that stood me well in later when we made the documentary ADD and Loving It, because we were taking on a pretty touchy topic. You know, I don't know if there was a more controversial diagnosis at the time. It's so much has been done to bust through and answer all of the myths and the misinformation, some of it very deliberate misinformation about what it is. And there's been so much research in the past 10, 15 years. So, yeah, so the ability to take things that sound, well, with ADHD, with a laser, you could see me burning something. With talking about ADHD, it was too easy to think, well, these people just need to try harder, which is what I kept telling myself until I was diagnosed. And eventually realized, you know what, I'm trying as hard as I can, and it's not working. And it was up to a point, you know, I had all sorts of success, 4 or 5 different TV series that ran for, 4 or 5 seasons mostly, with Red Green went 15. So yeah, it was, I was getting stuff done, but it was just killing me. I was working so hard, and that was not great. And now understanding what's going on, once I got diagnosed, it was just, okay, now I can understand why I'm able to produce skits, but I couldn't write a sitcom. I could never really master that. And a screenplay was just beyond me. That's 6 months work on a single project. Yeah, forget it. I'll go write 6 scenes for Red Green today, or whatever, 4, 5, 6, whatever. And so, yeah, the knowing, and this is what I always say, is that knowing about ADHD, knowing you have it, it's the one diagnosis where you want to find out. It is, in so many ways, a good news diagnosis. The disorder is not necessarily good news, because there's all sorts of problems that come with it, and costs, and health costs, and financial costs, and career, and damage to your family, and, you know, triple the rate of divorce and things like that. But if you don't know what's going on, you have no understanding of why things keep going wrong. So that was the power of that documentary, was being able to translate it and have Patrick McKenna, who has no background in science. You know, he came through the Second City system and then played Harold on the Red Green Show and other things as well. But having him, the two of us bouncing it back and forth, was great.
We had Pat McKenna on the show previously, and he told me about that documentary as well as his diagnosis with ADHD.
Yeah, well, if people are interested, what we've done is so entertaining. So whether you have it or not, or you know someone, and we all know somebody, because it's like 5, 6, 7% of the population, of the adult population, has it, has this mindset. And a lot of us do really well. You know, Richard Branson, and the guy who founded JetBlue, and the guy who founded Kinko's, and half the entertainment industry, you know, Channing Tatum, and so many other people have come out about it. So many musicians. Billy Joe Armstrong from Green Day said the whole band has it, and they've all got it, which makes sense. You're kind of constantly seeking novelty and so on. There's a lot of symptoms, and it looks a little different for each person. So it's very kind of individual. But it is also very situational. And when you understand what's going on and recognize how it's messing with you, how it keeps sabotaging your best efforts, then, okay, here's what I need to do instead. and you take strategies that work really well for ADHD.
I may not have ADHD, but I have some good friends of mine that that do have it, but it certainly doesn't have them.
That's good. Yeah, that's where you want to get to. Once you know what's going on, you've got a chance. Otherwise, you know, the analogy I use is that you're in a wrestling match with an invisible opponent, which is bad enough. But the worst part is you don't know you're in a wrestling match. So you think life is like this for everyone, that you can't keep track of stuff, that everybody loses their phone 9 or 10 times a day and can lose it 3 times in 10 minutes walking around the house. That's, you know, and that's funny at one point. I mean, we certainly had some comedy with it. But year after year, it's just wearing. And then when you realize it, you go, okay, so here's what I need to do. I've got to have one spot for my keys and wallet. I've got to have, it's got to be memorable. I've got to have it, and so on. So you go through, and there's in our YouTube channel, there's all kinds of videos, and we're making more thanks to our patrons. But yeah, there are all kinds of strategies that work. And then you can, you know, as your friends know, they have it, but it doesn't have them.
What's the name of that YouTube channel that you mentioned?
Oh, yeah. So it's about Rick's ADHD, and it's called, strangely, Rick Has ADHD. Thank you for, I'm never good at those kind of things. But yeah, Rick Has ADHD. We put out a Friday Funnies. We've been doing it for 7 or 8 years. They're hilarious. There's videos, and I usually write a lovely little funny introduction or a poignant introduction to the Friday Funnies. They're free to subscribe to. We're just in the process of changing things over. So it was called Rick Wants to Know. So rickwantstoknow.com. But I think the website may now, if it isn't this week, it will be within the next little while, rickhasadhd.com. And yeah, the Friday Funnies are a hoot. I think we've got 90,000 people subscribed, or no, it can't be that many. No, that's how many are subscribed to the channel. And then, I don't know, 10,000 or something get the Friday Funnies.
I know that you were appointed to the Order of Canada. And when you were appointed to that honor, you were recognized not only for your comedy and for your talent, but for your efforts towards raising awareness for ADHD as well. Is that correct?
Yeah. In fact, I think without that, there's lots of great comedy writers. I don't know that many that are as prolific as I was, 700 episodes of radio and television. But no, it was really because of the advocacy of the mental health. And the documentary that we did, ADD and Loving It, with a question mark and an exclamation mark, it just blew the lid off. Every expert I've talked to said it was a turning point, that their business tripled. Ran on PBS as one of those pledge programs, and it ran for, I think, 7 or 8 years. Now it's for free at the Rick Has ADHD channel. You can watch it through. It's the difference it makes. Well, when the documentary first aired, I'll tell you a simple example. So we were making this documentary. We had no idea what we're doing in some level because we're not doctors, and this is a medical condition. Or a mental health issue, it can be. And many people describe it, once they get it handled, as a superpower. You know, I don't know anyone else who's written as much as I have, as fast as I have. And when Steve and I started the Red Green Show, he said, I want to work with you because you're the only person that can keep up with me. So that was kind of cool. So the Order of Canada and the Order of Ontario, two of them, and a side order of Saskatchewan, I believe, comes with that. I don't know. Anyway, so the documentary airs on global television, and God bless them for funding it. They knew there would be pushback because the documentary basically says it's real. You know, that there's genes that have been identified, and brain scans show that we operate differently from other people, and thank God we do, because we can be very creative once we understand it. So the response was unbelievable. This was supposed to be a one-off documentary. My wife and I produced it. She was the editor on the Red Green Show for every episode but one, I think, the very first one. But after that, Ava took over and was the editor for all 15 seasons of it. So we produced this with Patrick and his wife, Janice. And Janice is, I think, is in some ways the star of the show. It's a, of the documentary. It's because it's a love story of the two of them. And it's so funny, them together going through stories of what they went through. It's funny and darkly funny. So then the Monday after it aired on a Friday. At Monday, Global Television calls and says, we don't know what to do with the response. We've never had so many people calling in wanting information. And they started forwarding all of this emailing and requests for help, which we knew was going to happen because the percentage of people, when we made that documentary, the percentage of people who were diagnosed, who had it and were undiagnosed, it was like 70, 80% probably.
So you were diagnosed later in life with ADHD. Does that mean that you had some struggles as a child?
Oh, yeah. I'm just in the process of making a video about my report cards because my mom saved them. So from kindergarten to grade six, I have these report cards. And it's, I mean, in some ways, it's hilarious. Ricky is fidgety. Little Ricky is Ricky this, needs to try harder. Rick's spelling is sloppy. Well, because we're in a rush and that's not important. I have so much to say, so many ideas. I don't have time to make it neat. Right? There was a long list of, and I look at them now, it's like, well, there's the symptom list from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for ADHD. There's like seven or eight of the 18 common signs the teachers have pointed out. And of course, back then, nobody knew what it was. It didn't really become ADHD, the title, until the 70s, mid-70s and late 70s. And it wasn't recognized in adults till we got into the 80s. And 90s even. So nobody had a term for it, but it was all laid out there. And the thing that I think is so frustrating, I mean, medicine progresses as it does, and mental health and all of it progresses slowly but surely. So it's a lot better than it was in 1860, you know, and 1714. Although here's the interesting thing. In 1798, Dr. Alexander Crichton, a Scottish doctor, listed basically the symptoms of ADHD. And he described these kids who didn't want to be troublemakers, but couldn't sit still, couldn't follow instructions, didn't seem to hear, tuned out, and so on. And then all through the 1800s, there were doctors in Germany and elsewhere who were describing these symptoms of these kids that just didn't seem to behave. And by the time, I think 1902, it was called a defect of moral control. Maybe that was the later one. Anyway, at one point it was called a defect of moral control. And then it became minimal brain dysfunction, which sounds awful. But I thought about it. And I thought, well, yeah, kind of that's what it is. You know, the brain doesn't necessarily function smoothly. And yet it also, when I'm locked in, when I'm going, I'm so hyper-focused. I'm unstoppable at that point. So, yeah, it's so interesting. I didn't finish the thought earlier, as I tend to do. It's late in the day. But when we made the documentary, this was going to be a one-off. And then we were going to go, I had a whole bunch of other comedy ideas I was going to do. But that response from people, you've saved my life. My child is dreaming for the first time. God bless you. My parents saw your show and phoned and said, honey, we're so sorry that we dismissed it and mocked you and so on. So we kind of took up this banner and just kept going, and it's still going. We took a break for 3 years, and now we're back again with Rick Has ADHD. And I'm glad to be back because it's joyful to make a difference for people. And I have to say, people with ADHD, a lot of them anyway, are pretty funny. And they're entertaining. And although some people are very quiet and more daydreamy, the talkative ones like myself get three of us going together. And it's a wall of sound. It's hilarious.
Along with the Red Green Show, you are also a member of a comedy troupe called The Frantics, I believe it's called. Is that right?
Yeah. So The Frantics, if you go to thefrantics.com, you'll see some of our stuff. We had a CBC radio series that ran for, I don't know, 4 years, 5 years. We did a couple of albums. We had a 13-part 13-episode season, but it was so expensive they couldn't afford to do another. They could have, but we didn't. It's a long story. But yeah, it was called Four on the Floor. And it's for people who were watching TV in the mid-80s, it was, there's a fellow in the States, I don't know if he's still broadcasting, Dr. Demento, comedy guy. And he plays all the best comedy, and he mentored Weird Al Yankovic and so on. And he said the Frantics are the funniest comedy troupe in the world who don't have a snake in their name. So to be told you're second to Monty Python is pretty cool. And there's one skit that we did that's gone immortal on Will Ferrell's Funny or Die. And it's called Her First Period. So probably not safe for work, but it's an example of what we did. And it was really interesting. So the Frantics was great. There was four of us. What I loved about it was we had very different skill sets. We're all funny. And when we wrote stuff, we would then bring it in and read. And every other show, every other troupe I've ever spoken to or heard of or how they operated, Saturday Night Live, all the writers' rooms, nobody, if you had a script for Saturday Night Live or whatever, nobody else would rewrite it. You, only you would. Well, with the Frantics, oh, give me that. I got some ideas for it. And there was no ego. So we just honed the stuff and it went around. We had short skits that went 12, 13 drafts, and they got better each time. And then they, you know, and then it's kind of lost the focus, but then you tighten it up and away it went. So that, what I learned there in doing that was just, I always want to work with other people because it's so much more interesting. I mean, I can go out and get my hockey stick and a ball and just take shots against the garage door, but just it's a lot more fun to go out with three or four other people and play two on two or whatever, you know. So it's just much more playful and it's way less lonely to do that. And so the Frantics was a real lesson in that. And it was a lesson about just letting go of ego and just seeing what other people could do. What you wrote was okay, but somebody would take it and run with it. And it was, oh my God, that's hilarious. Give it back. I've got some ideas now. I can, you know, I want to play with it.
How did you and Steve Smith develop the Red Green show? Because I do know that the character Red Green first appeared in the series Smith and Smith in the 80s.
Yeah, and Steve was, so I was with the Frantics, and Steve and his wife were doing that show. She was the other Smith in Smith and Smith. He was doing all the writing, and their show had songs, had straight songs and skits. And Steve did some monologues, and one of his characters was a takeoff on Red Fisher, so he called it Red Green because he thought, what's the perfect name? Now, I was working with the Frantics, and I had a character called Bill from Bala. Bala's city north of, up on, like, in the Muskoka Lakes, up near where my family actually had a cottage. And and Bill from Bala would ramble on and on. And again, I'm sure on the frantics.com, you'll be able to find it in there somewhere. And he could just, he would drive people nuts by just going on and on. It was great fun. So that was on radio. That character never made it to television, actually, which is funny. But I had done, as in my late teens, maybe my early 20s, done some physical comedy, goofing around. My brother, who was ended up studying film for a while, and then ended up becoming a really awesome renovator. He's brilliant. But anyway, he would film. We would go out in the behind the cottage and just do physical comedy. I'd goof around and he would film it. So when I showed Steve some of this stuff, he said, oh yeah, we got to have this because it's outdoors. And nobody back then. Well, actually, I don't know. That's sweeping, but I don't recall anyone else doing pure physical comedy like that. You know, I mean, it was basically silent comedy, except Steve narrated a bit. And so it was really unique. I wasn't trained as a clown, as a tumbler, as a stunt person, any of that, but I could make the movement funny. I could have fun with it. And so the character I did was Bill Smith. So there's where the confusion comes often for people. So, oh, is it the red and green show because of red and then Rick Green? No, it was Red Green, played by Steve Smith, and Bill Smith, played by Rick Green. Got it? No. So it was confusing. But he asked me to write for Smith & Smith because he asked the Frantics, and everybody else was like, it's not my cup of tea. And I said, well, I got a baby on the way. Not me, but my wife did. And I said, okay, I'll work with you. And so we collaborated on that and then a following project called Comedy Mill. And then that won the Gemini Award Best Comedy, beat out all of the Codco and all the other big shows. And then even though it was just coming out of a little station in Hamilton, and then the show got canceled. And so Steve took it elsewhere, and bit by every year he managed to, for 2 or 3 years, managed to find another broadcaster who would pick it up. At one point, YTV was running it, was sponsoring or helping to sponsor it. And then the CBC finally picked it up and it took off. But it was for the first 3, maybe 4 seasons, the writing was just he and I. The adventures with Bill, I directed. The studio stuff, they had a different Larry Schnur was the director, and small crew, small cast. The adventures with Bill was basically the 2 writers were there, that was Steve and I. The cast was there, that was Steve and I. The director and producer were there, that was me, and Steve was the producer. And then we had a camera person, a camera assistant who did anything that needed doing. And then we had our props, costume, catering, location manager, transportation. All of that was one woman, Sandy Richardson. And that was that was it. So there were 5 of us out there doing this goofiness. Now, as the seasons went on, the budget increased. Once we were on CBC, we were able to have a bigger crew. Sometimes we were out there with 2 cameras for the handyman corners. And the show, I think we've talked a little bit about it since then, and even at the time, but I realized what we were doing was trying to make each other laugh, which is what the Frantics was about, was trying to get the other guys to laugh. And so if I could make Steve laugh or he could make me laugh, it's golden, right? And that we were writing for each other. There was no one saying you need women in the show. The host can't have a beard. You know, there's no show on television where a host has a beard. We're doing that anyway. So what? And part of the reason was the budget to begin with was so small. The network kind of, what was Steve's joke about? They gave us enough money to do something, but not enough like they that they felt like they had the right to offer any suggestions or notes. And of course, it caught on. Because it wasn't trying to please everybody, and there was a conscious decision not to have women on the show, because as a woman professor actually said, it's a great idea because we know how you behave when we're around, and we didn't want to be doing wife jokes and things like that. Rodney Dangerfield does those well, but so that was it, and it kind of organically grew, and then eventually you had Gordon Pinsent and Graham Greene and other people wanting to be part of the show. It was just pretty awesome.
I do seem to recall that Dalton Humphrey made quite a few wife jokes during his time on the show. He owned the Dalton Humphrey's Everything store.
Yeah, now it's interesting because I wasn't with the show. I went off and was doing a separate show for 4 years in the middle of the run, doing History Bites for History Television, which was, I think, maybe the thing I'm most proud of. Well, I don't know if it's the most, but it was pretty neat. It was called the cleverest Canadian comedy ever, which I thought was clever. And again, there's a YouTube channel called History Bites Official, and it's pretty cool.
About Adventures with Bill, those segments were made to look like they were shot on old home movie film. Was that actually a home movie film that you used, or was that just a post-production effect?
Well, it's interesting. So when we went out for the very first shoot, Steve wanted to do them on 16 millimeter film. So they had a look of older, kind of from the 50s. When we got there and started shooting, the cameraman discovered that half the film he bought was black and white. So we were either going to shut down and not shoot anymore that day, or Adventures with Bill was going to be black and white. And that's what happened. So they were shot on 16 millimeter for probably a season, maybe two. And then video cameras were so much more portable that we were able to take video out. And then there were these computer programs, and this was the very early days of this stuff, but they could make it look older and granular and stuff. You know how even on your phone, you have cinematic and all these different things. So there were all these settings that they could do, or filters, software, they could run it through to make it look more like 16 millimeter. And then they would lay over top of that what's called a scratch reel, which was basically somebody took a bunch of 16 millimeter film, black film, and scraped and ran over it and crumpled it all up and then ran it through and turned it into a videotape. So it looked like old movies that had been chewed up by the projectors and stuff. And yeah, the decision was really just that's what we had. And I'm so glad because it separated everything out from the rest of the show. And it explained partly why you never heard what Bill was saying and Steve was narrating. And then, of course, the critics were talking about it being an homage to the great comedy of the silent comedians of Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton and so on. So, yeah, it's kind of, it definitely is that kind of comedy, but mostly it's just because that's what we had.
Well, it sounds like you've had an amazing career, and I wish you all the best going forward. And
thank you.
Rick, thank you very much for joining us this time on the Medley.
Well, you're welcome.
I hope that you enjoyed the interview with Rick Green. And if you know of somebody that you think would be a good guest for the Medley, don't hesitate to contact me. Just visit my website, blakecrashpriddle.com. Until next time, here at the Medley, we're all kinds of different.